It was just an ordinary rainy day, like so many in the Pacific Northwest. And then the earth started to move near Oso, Washington. In short order, a fast-moving wall of mud choked the Stillaguamish River and swallowed neighborhoods whole. 43 people died. This happened 2 years ago last month, and now we call Oso the deadliest mudslide in U.S. history. It unleashed unforeseen tragedy for the people affected, but the conditions that led up to it are commonplace in our region, which is very prone to landslides. Our guest today is a landslide expert from Portland State University, here to talk about what happened at Oso and how we can be ready for geologic change. Dr. Scott Burns is giving a talk on these subjects at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay on April 16th, and he joins us by phone now. Dr. Burns, welcome to The Exchange.
Good to be with you this morning.
Great to have you here. So, thinking about Oso, I'm going to stick with this image of this fast-moving wall of mud and these just catastrophic events in March 2014. How long did it take the Oso slide to do the damage that we're still totaling today?
This whole landslide that came down from one side of the valley, it traveled completely across the valley in 60 seconds.
Wow.
So the people in the buildings had no chance of knowing what was going on or getting out. And we are talking like 10 million cubic yards of soil and water and debris and trees that came down.
Wow, that's so much to take in. I mean, 10 million cubic yards, I can't really imagine how much or what that is. But 60 seconds and the catastrophe that it unleashed, was this a fluke? I mean, was Oso something that happens ever so often in geologic history? Or what led to this, you know, this level of destruction and of humans being in the path of a landslide?
Well, first of all, in Western Oregon, Western Washington, and Northern California, we have huge numbers of these very, very big, large landslides when we look at that. So being a geologist, what we do is we go out into the field, and you can read the landscape, and you can tell it there's been a landslide in an area because they're generally a place where it has broken away and then moved down the slope. And Mother Nature likes to make smooth slopes, but as a landslide come down, it is bumpy, hummocky topography with a toe down near the bottom. And so we see these. A lot of them are forested, so you don't really know that they are there, but they are there. We do have a new technique in the all over the world called LIDAR. It's a laser imaging that is attached to a plane flying over an area. We can get images of the ground, so we can see the ground through the trees. And with this, we can map all of the landslides. And so a technique that we developed at Portland State now that is used at our State Geological Survey in Oregon at Dogami.
We had one of their scientists on the program not too long ago talking about LIDAR and how they've mapped the state, and so much of it is landslide prone.
Yes, and so you either had either Bill Burns, my old student, or Ian Maiden.
Ian Maiden.
And who's in charge of the project. And it's amazing to us how many old landslides are there. In the Oso Valley, once the landslide came down, they took LIDAR of the area, and they saw, wow, one after another in this valley. And so we had never looked at it before because in the Pacific Northwest, we really have never invested money in going out and getting LIDAR and seeing where all the old landslides are. We have a rule of thumb. If it has moved once, it has a chance of moving again. And right next to the Oso landslide, there is one that came down 1,200 years ago. And it was bigger than the one that killed all of these people back in March 22nd, year 2014.
How do you know it was 1,200 years ago?
They radiocarbon dated it. And so when we go out to study a landslide, what we do is we look for trees or bushes or woody debris that has come down that's in the landslide mass, and it died as the landslide came down. And if it's a tree, what we do is we date the wood right underneath the bark, and that tells you when the tree died. So the most studied landslide in the Pacific Northwest is the Bridge of the Gods landslide, which is in the Columbia Gorge between Oregon and Washington. And that came down 550 years ago. And we did that by dating trees that we pulled out of the landslide. So in retrospect, we should have known that whole valley was going to have these huge, fast-moving landslides coming down.
Let's talk more about that. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Burns. He's Emeritus Professor of Geomorphology, Soils, Environmental Geology, and a landslide expert at Portland State University. I'm Emily Curitan, and you are invited to join this discussion. Phone number is 800-838-3760, or you can email us jx@jeffnet.org. So, Scott, why, in a nutshell, what are the main factors that make the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, and Washington in particular, so prone to landslides?
Well, first of all, we have steep slopes. And then number two, we have a lot of rainfall. And water is always the key. And we have earthquakes. So the two things that will set off a landslide are earthquakes and water. The good news is we don't have large numbers of earthquakes, but when we do, like the big one, boy, they cause a lot of landslides. And so these periods in between are big earthquakes. It's mostly water. And that's where you get a huge amount of rainfall and precipitation in a short period of time, and so the soils don't get a chance to actually drain themselves. Do you remember back in 1996, we had two major rainfall events, one that hit the northern half of the state in southern Washington, and that was in February of 1996. And then in November and December of 1996, Douglas County in the southern part of the state just got hammered. And we had lots and lots of landslides at those particular two periods of time. We always have them, especially in the wintertime. But that one year, wow, it was a banner year. That's a geologist speaking. For landslides, for homeowners, not a good idea.
Yeah, if you remember 1996, do give us a call, 800-838-3760. Scott, you mentioned, you know, water is the key. We have these steep slopes. Ian Maiden, when he was on the program, he talked about the rocks of Oregon. They're relatively weak rocks.
Yes.
What about human activities? To what extent do they contribute to some of the better-known landslides of recent memory?
Yeah. Humans can undercut the slope, for instance. A lot of times they will, especially if at the bottom of the slope, they cut into it. What it does is it loses the buttressing effect, and then the whole thing will start sliding down. We worked on a landslide in Astoria, Oregon, on that, which caused whole housing development up above to start moving, coming down, or adding too much weight to the slope, and that increases the driving forces. Landslides are always driving forces versus resisting forces. The soil will resist the movement, but then the driving forces are the gravity or the weight that is on the slope. When you add a lot of water to the slopes, that reduces the resisting forces and adds weight and causes landslides to occur. And so every time we analyze a slope, we go out and say, what are the resisting forces? What are the driving forces that are there?
So you talked about LIDAR, using laser images to essentially look through the trees and see landslide-prone areas. Maybe if someone had done this at OSA Washington, they would have had a greater sense of the danger there. What are the other tools for predicting where and when landslides will occur?
Well, LIDAR is the godsend to us, helping us make these really, really good maps. What we do is we map where the landslides have occurred once in the past. So if they occurred once, they have a high chance of happening again. Doesn't mean they will if you control the water. And so with those, then we produce susceptibility maps. That is, where would we expect landslides to occur in the future? And so we're trying to do those for all of Western Oregon, Western Washington, and Southern California. State of Washington just gave huge amounts of money, the legislature, to their geological survey to do this. Oregon turned it down. There is a national bill to also do this, too.
To create a susceptibility map?
Yes. Mm-hmm. What we need are susceptibility maps for all of, especially western portions of our state and Northern California. And then those have to be used by the planners of each one of the counties and the cities. And so if you are in a high to moderate zone for susceptibility for landslides, the planners need to know, hey, maybe this is not a good place to build. Or sometimes, if you have a really good geotechnical engineer, they say, oh, if we do this, this, and this, we can overcome the landslides. But at least we have to know where they are. And right now, we don't have those. Only just a very few places do we have maps like that. So we're trying to get our state to put some money into that. Washington has put huge amounts, and it's all because of OSO. OSO is our national poster child for landslides.
And you've mentioned Dogami a couple of times, the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Before this interview, I was actually studying a map that they put out recently showing little dots, basically, of where landslides are and where places are prone to landslides. And they tend to be along roads. Roads obviously tend to be built in places that water has already channelized a lot of the time. If you live in one of these communities that maybe is socked in on a single road, or you're already a property owner in a place that's landslide prone, what good is a susceptibility map to you? I mean, what do you do with that information?
Well, first of all, if you are on an old landslide or in a highly prone area, it tells you you have to make sure you control the water on your property. And there, if you go, all of our cities, in the southern northern part of the state, we have cities with houses on steep slopes. And they're houses that are 100, 150 years old. Why? Because they've always controlled the water. When we were back in 1996, we mapped over 700 landslides in the Portland area. And every one of them, we always asked the question, where did the water come from? A lot of them, 9% of them, were broken water systems, broken gutters, broken pipes, where water would a drain would be filled up and water would run over a parking lot and saturate the slope. 9% of those landslides were a result of concentration of water on the slope. And so if you live in a highly prone area, and that's based on the soils and the slope and past landslides, all of this stuff, you need to control the water. That's the key thing. But you can live in an area that is prone. You just got to be careful.
And take proactive measures. We've got some callers on the line. Let's go to one now. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. Landslide, we're looking at one. And we have I have a question, very specific. If you have a fairly substantial landslide and at the bottom of it, somebody wants to dig 70-foot gravel pit. How does that affect the likelihood of this landslide kicking loose again and saying, oh, I remember this, let's fly?
All right, Wolfgang, so doing a gravel pit at the bottom of a landslide sounds maybe not like a great idea.
It is not. And any time you do anything to the toe of an ancient landslide, you have the chance of reactivating it. So either cutting off the toe or, in this case, digging a gravel pit below the landslide could reactivate it.
What do you mean when you say toe of the landslide?
So the bottom part.
The bottom.
So it's a very steep part generally where the thing has moved down in the past. And we know this in forestry. We tell people do not cut trees at the toes of landslides or the scarps, the upper part, because you may reactivate the landslide. And our forest practices laws now put that into use. And so if people are going to put a gravel pit in, they have to go to generally a board to have it okayed. I'm hoping that the people who are making the decisions will say, hey, there's a large old ancient landslide up above, and by digging a gravel pit, and generally you will, the models will show us. We can put 3D computer models on this, and if the factor of safety drops below one, there's a high potential for a landslide occurring. So it is not a good idea. And so you have asked an absolutely great question. Not a good idea. And the other thing is, even if houses, the reason we spend so much time trying to prevent them is landslides are not covered by normal homeowners insurance. So if your house is on a landslide that reactivates, you lose everything. Or if your house is hit by a landslide coming down the hill, you lose everything. And so until we have a national all-hazard insurance, which is way off in the future, landslides are not going to be covered, and so we're trying to save lives and save property and money.
And it sounds like the science is really advancing rapidly in terms of being able to map these areas and perhaps give, say, an insurance company something to work with about, well, what is the risk here? Is it insurable? That kind of thing. I'm shocked to learn that landslides aren't part of home insurance. Yeah, let's go right to another call, though. John and Vanita, here's John on the air. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I find this so fascinating. Just last night, I was watching a history show, and they were using LIDAR, and they were unveiling these ancient cities that nobody had any idea. Or they had idea, but it was like hand-me-down history, verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And Cambodia is where it was. But I got a couple things I'd like to touch on real quick here, because it's so interesting to me. I wanted to ask the guest if he, and I know this is on the other side of the Cascades, but if he knows about the huge flash flood. I know that's not a landslide, but to me, you get hit with one or the other, it's kind of, you're done. But it was at the time, if I remember, it's been some time ago, and my books are all packed up, so I can't find it, but it even had a picture, and it just hit, and I think it was Enterprise. And it just hit and just completely done away with the town. If I remember right, it was the biggest natural disaster in the country at the time. And the weird thing is there was Nez Perce women that were bringing in like bundles of kindling. They'd trade with the people, the white folks. Okay, they even warned them. They were looking at the sky, and of course they ignored them. And they did their business and left town. And it hit, and it was quite the thing, and it really left a mark in my mind. That was one thing I wanted him to comment on. And then the other thing is, real quick, my dad, who just passed away here recently,
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And he lived a long, great life. He was around before all the dams, and he had a lot of memories of dairy herds floating down the river, dead. Barns, houses, everything. I mean, in the winter, the stories he would tell is like people now that weren't around would have a hard time even understanding it. And then they built this Riverbend Hospital down here. You're in Eugene, a regional hospital. It's a big thing. Beautiful hospital.
Uh-huh.
And it's right there. I mean, look right down the gun sights of all those dams going up all the way to Hills Creek. A lot of water.
John, let's let Scott Burns get in here with a response on your question about flash flooding.
Thank you so much. Great show. Bye-bye.
All right, Dr. Burns, flash flooding and developing in these areas.
It is a big deal. And John, thank you very much. The flood that you talked about, I think, was in the Walla Walla Valley. So it's really, I think it was still in Oregon, but it was up in that part of the state, the Walla Walla Valley. Native Americans knew that it had occurred in the past. We know where past floods are, and so we try and map these types of things, where the 100-year flood is, and where the 250-year flood is. Anytime you build below dams, if that dam breaks, everything is toast downstream from that, and we all know that. That's why we go and check dams continuously, not only for strength but also for earthquakes, and because we don't want to have them breaking, we don't want the water coming down, and very, very important for us because the safety of people and safety of property are very important.
And on the question of flash flooding, I mean, in Oso, the floods, when the river got all of the mass from the landslide, it essentially dammed it and flooded upstream areas, right? And that was a whole other layer.
And one of the reasons why it traveled so fast was the river was high, because the month of March, it was the second highest rainfall record for that month on record. And so as the slide came down, it had a lot of water in it, but then also it picked up all the water in the stream and all the water that was coming down a flooding river, and so it turned it into a goo, and we call it a debris flow. It's a debris avalanche landslide came down that it turned into a debris flow, and it was a gooey mess that the rescuers, they spent $150 million in the rescue and follow-up on that, and the reason was it was like playing in quicksand. It's a real big problem that we have.
Let's try to fit another call in here with about a minute left. John and Grants Pass, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. Tell us about the angle of repose. I saw that on a documentary about the Panama Canal where they had to cut the steepness of the hill because down there, my gosh, the ground must be saturated. So anyway, tell us about that.
Yes, so angle of repose is generally 32, 33 degrees, and that is the natural angle that rocks will hold a slope. But as the particle size gets smaller, as you get down into clay, the angle of repose is like 10 degrees, and that's your stability angle. That is so when you cut slopes or you cut into slopes, you never want to go above 33 degrees. If you do, then you have to have retaining walls that are there.
I see.
And so that's Mother Nature's natural angle of stability.
So different materials have this
exactly.
term. This is a technical term, angle of repose. It's kind
right.
of poetic sounding, actually. So, for example, the kind of soils in Oso, they have they needed more of an angle of repose?
You had a river undercutting at uh-huh. the toe of the slope. It's a little more complicated than tack the upper part of the slope was straight up and down.
Wow.
But it was just saturated because of all. They had a previous slide in 2006 that kind of dammed up the lower part, so it held a lot of water in back of it from the rainfall that month. But the angle of repose is, it's a no-brainer. As you get a slope steeper and steeper and steeper, the stability also goes down. And so highway department, when they come through, they will cut a slope into bedrock or to the soils below the angle of repose for that particular area.
Our guest has been Dr. Scott Burns, Emeritus Professor of Geomorphology, Soils, and Environmental Geology at Portland State. He is giving a talk at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay on April 16th at 7 p.m. You can find more details on our website, jeffexchange.org. Dr. Burns, thank you so much for being here.
Emily, thank you very much for the invitation.